Accession number 27807, Mr. Harry Hooper, Reel 1. Could you tell me when and where you were born, Mr. Hooper?
Yes, I was born on the 6th of October 1924 at a place called the Depot Farm in North Hyde, near Southall in Middlesex. Actually, right on the northern boundary of what was then Heston Airfield, became Heston Airport of Chamberlain fame.
And could you tell us a bit about your family background?
Yeah, my father was one of three brothers. Both my father and his elder brother ran farms, which were owned by my grandfather, who also was quite big in horse transport for the laundries and God knows what. The other brother ran a pub, which was also owned by my grandfather. Basically, farming was pig farming. We owned something like, at any one time, 400 to 1,000 pigs in quite modern systems for those days. And being on the edge of the airport, I started seeing planes, aircraft, light aircraft at a very early stage. And then in 1927, the end of 27, I think it probably was, we moved further into, or nearer to Heston, a small village in West Middlesex, an area which had once been the sort of market garden for West London. It had been fruit trees, and most of West London's horse manure was carted out and dumped on the fields and became a very fertile area for growing crops for the London markets.
Now, your family were comfortably off.
We always had a car, to the best of my memory, yes. We always had a car. My father fought in the First World War, obviously.
Who with?
He was in the Royal Fusiliers in the Sportsman's Battalion. Battalion raised by Lady Cundiff Owen. She raised and paid for it, and so they had better uniforms. And when my father says when they were in France, they had much better food because she supplied it than the normal battalions in the Fusiliers. He was wounded twice, not severely, had two fingers badly injured. But he also had been a professional boxer, quite a good one. He fought the world lightweight champion in a fight for the troops, a demonstration sort of fight in France, a man called Jerry Delaney. And he was into sport, as I've always been, interested in it, but not terribly good at it. Well, growing up in Heston, I went to the local... I couldn't go into the local Heston Junior School because they were full up. And so I had to wait until they built a new school near Cranford in Middlesex. And that was Berkeley Junior School. It opened actually on the 6th of October, my 6th birthday, in 1930. I always remember it. And there we had 8 classes, I believe, or 7 classes. Well, there were no men in the school at all. All the teachers were women, and even the person that took us for football was a woman. We had Mr. Godfrey, who was the caretaker, and it was a marvellous school. We learned to read and write and do things like that. And then when I was 11, coming up to 12, I won what was called then the scholarship, or passed the scholarship, although my father still had to pay. And I went to Isleworth County Grammar School in Isleworth, West London. I did 3 terms there, and my father sold or got out of the farm at Heston, and we moved down into Surrey near Egham, a place called Strood, in Strood Farm. We stayed there. My father's heavily into gambling all his life, and gradually what money had was frittered away. We stayed there for just a year. We went in the August of 37, and we left again in July 38. During that period, I did 2 terms at Strode School at Egham, and that was the end of my schooling. I left when I was still 13.
Now, how did you do at school, would you say?
It sounds like boasting. I always came top. I was competitive. I liked to win things in those days. So I was always top of the class, always. Then when I went to Isworth County School, which was a grammar school, we didn't have the same sort of term exams. And I don't know where I did at Isworth. I just did three terms and we moved. When I was at Strode's, I went straight into a third form there. I'd been in a second form prior to that at Isworth. I went straight into third form, did two terms and left. After I left, I got the prize for being top again, which was Lincoln Ellsworth's Beyond Horizons, which I liked.
Were there any particular subjects you were good at or liked or disliked?
I liked arithmetic, anything to do with maths. I could add up very quickly in my head. I still can, really. I liked geography and history. Geography I was particularly strong at. I still love history. I helped my wife do her crosswords because I can tell her the rivers and the capitals and God knows what. When we moved from Egham, Strood, we moved to a place called Harlington, which is just to the north of what is now Heathrow Airport. And my father, being into gambling, knew the manager of the Harlington Greyhound Racing Track. He was always there. And he asked my father if I would go over and help lead dogs around at the racetrack. This was in 1938, in the early summer. So I went over to the racetrack and I learned how to lead a dog, put it in the kennel and then collect it after the race. And I did sort of the summer into September 39. By that time, I'd gone on to starting the dogs, and that is pulling the trap lever to start them off. I was still, I don't know, 15 then. And 14, actually, still. I then became the driver of the hare.
Now, tell us a bit more about that, because we do social history as well.
Yeah, right.
And we've never had the Greyhound Stadiums were a big thing then, and they're not so big now.
No.
What was it?
Well, there were two classes of Greyhound racing in Britain in those days. There were the GRA tracks, Greyhound Racing Associations, which was a sort of ascot of racing, dog racing. And those were the big tracks, the Wembley and Wimbledon, where crowds of 20, 30, 40,000 would, and they raced in the evenings under lights. There were also known tracks known as flapping tracks. They were unlicensed by the GRA, which didn't matter very much, but they were small tracks run by odd people that liked greyhound racing, I presume. And there you would get a crowd of 200 to 300, maybe up to 400 or 500. And most of the racing was sort of afternoon racing, so it didn't conflict with the major evening racing. But Harlington was owned by the Southall Greyhound Racing Company, and it kennelled no dogs. Well, it had one, but apart from that, the dogs and owners brought their dogs. The dogs came from Southall, owners brought their dogs in. They had previously trialled to find out their sort of rough time so they could be handicapped or not. And there were six races in the afternoon. There were a line of bookmakers along the front of the stand. And the boys, the dogs were put in kennels as they arrived. And then as they were, the races were called, a small identification number was placed over their backs and a muzzle on the heads. And they were led up and down the parade ground so that people would make their mistakes and lose their money. Then they were walked to the trap where little doors at that, there were six traps, and the door opened, the dog was pushed in. I do believe that sometimes their tails were caught in, on purpose, I believe, too. And then the handle was pulled, the hare came round, and they followed the hare round, and then the dogs were taken back, put back in the kennels or given back to their owners. There's quite a lot of money going around and wasting there. And having sort of started leading dogs around and then gone on to sort of doing the starting and then driving the hare.
What does driving the hare mean?
Well, I don't know very much about the large greyhound tracks, but it's at Harlington, if you can picture it, was roughly an oval. And the inside of the track, the oval, had a sort of 4 or 5 strand wire guard fence. And underneath that was a small rail, or wire rather, running on pulleys. To that, attached the hare was on a small tubular sled. There was a drive from a large electric motor, which was placed under a raised, almost control tower, the sort of elementary airfield control tower. And in there was a massive great lever. You pulled the lever to energize the motor. And the more you pulled the lever, the faster the motor went and the faster the hare went. There was a trick to this because the oval wasn't really an oval. There were 4 straights and 4 bends. And if you didn't slow down as you got to the bend, centrifugal force would push the hare right to the outside of the bend and all the dogs would follow unless they just ran on the inside. So there was room for sort of manipulation of the races, I believe. I didn't do that, of course.
Well, I wondered about, I mean, it's got a pretty dodgy reputation.
Yes.
Well, I don't know whether it's justified or not. Was there much fiddling, corruption? Were you aware of it?
No, I wasn't, because bearing in mind I was young, and I'm not sure it was big enough to have, there wasn't enough money there, I suppose, to make, you know, corruption worthwhile. There might have been the odd dog who had been held back in trials so that he, you know, when he raced, he was the second fast. So it took about 30 seconds to go around this track.
Did you have any interest in gambling yourself?
No, I have never, ever gambled. I don't, but I occasionally buy raffle tickets, but only for the Bomber Command Association. My father gambled, and we lost farm after farm and money and God knows what. So,
it was your father that made you
my father. Yeah, I think so. Although I wasn't conscious of it, but I've never thought gambling was terribly clever. If I couldn't make it happen, then I didn't like it. I've always tried to do things which I knew I could make work. And if I, you know, gambling isn't like that. There's a lot of luck or other in it, so it's not for me.
Now, just in this early period, your childhood, best. Before we go on to the actual war, let's talk a couple more things. What the first thing is sport. How interested in sport were you? I mean, you said you weren't that good, but did you play at school?
I played soccer at school, football, and I was always in the school team from the age of 8. When I got to the county grammar school, I didn't play at all because I was just there for 3 years, and the sort of school teams were the under 14s, which I really didn't get to aspire to that level. The level was very good there. The two of the boys played for England schoolboys. And, of course, the main school team, which went up to 16, 17-year-olds. I did boxing. My father taught me to box, and I boxed at school and beat up nearly everyone I knew there, right up to 2 or 3 years older than myself. I followed cricket, but only through player cigarette cards and the press. I followed England, and I followed Middlesex as a county, and I still remember the great days of Compton and Edrick. I've still got an enormous interest in sport. I read the Telegraph from cover to cover, but sport, I read every sport article, whether it's cycling or badminton, anything, it's sport. I like it.
And you've always had that interest?
Always.
Now, the other thing is, let's talk a bit about your interest in flying. You mentioned it very briefly, but this is just your interest, not about joining the RAF. This is, tell me about, it was tremendously popular, air activities and things before the Second World War.
There were, yes.
What was it for you? Tell me.
Well, for me, living at Heston, from the age of 6 to 12, being right next door to Heston Airfield, I was conscious of light planes flying around all the time. Indeed, I can recall being in our farmyard and seeing a plane come spiralling down and crash in the field across the way into a pile of wood. That was cuttings from a fruit orchard. It landed in the middle of the orchard. And the men on the farm rushing over and recovering the pilot. And I was told he rushed back to Heston Airfield and jumped straight into an aeroplane, as the chap who's fallen off his horse is supposed to do, and flew again. Whether he did, I don't know. But Heston was quite well known. Captain Baker, I recall, was a chief instructor, I think. And even in those days, I knew his name. Also, British Airways, the British Airways of those days, which was just European flying, brought their Lockheed 12s and Lockheed 14s into Heston. Indeed, that's one of their aircraft brought Chamberlain back from Munich and landed at Heston, and he waved his piece of paper around. But it was there that I really started being very interested in flying. I started buying aeronautical journals then, odd ones, when I had enough money, flight and the aeroplane, mainly the aeroplane of those days, they were sixpence. I had an uncle who lived nearby, my mother's brother, and he was a marvellous man. He and his wife had no children, and they regarded me as their sort of child almost. They had lived with us on various occasions, looked after, helped my mother. And he used to collect me when he came home from work in the summer evenings. I would sit on his crossbar, he would take me round to his house, and as he had been in working on building sites, he used to bring home firewood, just floorboards I suppose, and from those he cut little pieces, and we carved out aeroplanes, small aeroplanes. And I always recall that we were very keen on making propellers, which we carved out and then burnt a small hole through and put the pin through, and then we tried them out by blowing at them, and you know, they worked. And I thought, oh, that's amazing, isn't it, how you just blow at this thing and it goes round. So that, I suppose, was my early introduction to flying, actually.
Did you have any chance to get a flight? Or, you know, because they used to have civilian flights.
They did. No, I didn't. The nearest I got to it was with my uncle, who would take me round to the near the main entrance of Heston, and we could get through the hedge. It was just a simple hedge. And we could watch aircraft taking off and landing. But I never actually got within 500 yards of an airplane.
Were you all very aware of the First World War? Air War, you know, the Aces. I mean, were they household names then still?
They were to me, because my father and I were avid readers, and we used to buy, they were Thruppenny magazine, well, pulp. There were pulp westerns, which were threepence in those days, came over from the States in large numbers. But also, there were pulp Air War books, and most of them sort of featured Eddie Rickenbacker and Americans, and they always had Spads and beat the Germans. But from that age, I knew about Fokkers and the D1 and the Fokker Tripes and the Spads and Sop with Camels and Pups and things like that. So from the age of probably 8 or 9, I knew aircraft. I could identify aircraft. I knew the Lockheed 14. I could tell the difference between a 12 and a 14.
Now, before the war, you hadn't been in any of the cadet movements, had you?
No, I hadn't. I didn't join anything.
Not even the Boy Scouts?
No, I didn't. I was always, we had a, you know, the farm, and because there were new housing estates going up in those days and in that area, I had a number of friends from schools, and we had a sort of small football pitch on the farm. We either played cricket in the summer there during our summer holidays, or we played football with, on Saturday afternoons, the men on the farm, including my father and an uncle who lived nearby, came and played football.
Now, were you aware of the approach of war at all? You'd be 14, 15, 38, 39.
Yeah.
Were you aware of the approach of war?
Oh, yes. I was interested in war. My father had taken, during the 30s, a new periodical, a weekly periodical that came out, and I'm not quite sure, but it was a man called Hamilton was the editor, quite well known, I think, in those days. And this was a pictorial a record of the First World War, and we got it every week. My father read it, and we went through it, and he told me about the trenches and fighting and bully beef, and Ticklers jam, things like that from the Ticklers factory itself, or plum jam. So I grew up in an atmosphere that I was knowledgeable about war. I was knowledgeable about flying for a kid of 8, 9, or 10 in those days, with no outside help. It was something in me, I suppose. I just liked aircraft.
Now, what about Nazi Germany, Hitler, that sort of thing? Were you aware of that?
I was conscious by 1936-37, because I read the then News Chronicle, a liberal paper my father took. I not only read the sports section, I read the paper, and I was conscious that, maybe even apprehensive, that there might be a war with Germany. And I was also conscious, because there were a lot of propaganda around in those days, that we would be bombed. And a lot of people of those days were scared stiff, if you ask them. They really thought that if war broke out, Germany would bomb London, would bomb all our towns, and we would suffer. There would be gas attacks, and it was going to be pretty hideous. So I suppose, because of that, a lot of people were very keen to avoid war. And to an extent, I think Chamberlain thought he was doing right by the countries, what the people want. They didn't want a war in 1938, so Chamberlain said, here you are, we're not going to have a war. He wasn't very bright, of course. He had misunderstood Hitler.
Now, what about the outbreak? I don't know what was. You were working at the Greyhound Stadium.
Yes, I was.
Now, what happened? Because something seems to have happened on September the 1st, 2 days before the Declaration of War. Well,
you probably will recall that on September the 1st, Hitler marched into Poland in the early hours, and we all knew about it on the radio and in the press. And we had a race meeting Friday afternoon, as usual. Dogs came over from Southall, our main headquarters, and owners brought their dogs, and the race meeting took on. The race meeting finished at about 5:30, and I started sweeping up the area in front of the stands where the punters had thrown their betting slips. And suddenly Jack Rowley, who was the manager, he was the only other employee. Jack had been a major in the First World War and held in some awe by myself and my father. He'd been an officer. He came up to me and said, Harry, I'm afraid we're finished. Southall have been on the phone. We're closing down for the duration of the war. So that's it. He said, it's you and me for the Labour Exchange Monday morning. On Sunday, I do recall listening to Chamberlain, the Prime Minister, announcing we were now at war with Germany. And immediately sirens went. I was living at Harlington, north of Heathrow. And my mother rushed in and said, Harry, go and get your sister Betty. She's in the Harlington Church at the children's lesson or something. And I had to run down and I fetched my sister, and we ran back in fear and trembling, waiting for the bombs to come. They never did. And that was that. But I was out of work.
Now, hang on. With the Declaration of War, how did your father feel about it? I mean, how did you feel? I mean, because you were... I know you were 15 or so. Yeah.
Well, I was coming up to 15 in 39, September.
How did you feel about it? Because you're only 3 or 4 years off when you'd be involved. I mean, did you think you'd be involved? What did you think?
No, I didn't. One I saw was an opportunity. I don't know how soon I saw it, but I saw that I knew that I'd never be able to learn to fly an aircraft unless something happened, other than, you know, sort of my normal life proceeding as it had, because we wouldn't afford it, I hadn't got any education and so forth. But when the war was started, I thought, now here's a chance, maybe I'll be able to join the Air Force. I'm not sure whether I thought I'd fly an aircraft, but I thought I'll join the Air Force. And I was, bearing in mind I was taking flight in the airplane then, I had 10 shillings a week coming in from the Greyhound racing, so I bought flight on the airplane Thursday and Friday when they came out.
So that was your interest. I mean, for you, the war starting in a way was an
opportunity
to join the
RAF. Absolutely. And of course, there was much more interest generally in aircraft because the RAF was expanding in those days. You saw pictures in the paper of aircraft, and I followed it very intensely in the flight and airplane.
But now, so Monday morning, and you're on
yes,
the dole.
Monday morning, I got on the bus with Jack Rowley in Harlington, and we went into Hayes, Middlesex, and we reported at the Labour Exchange at about 9 o'clock, and we stood in the queue. And he went through, and I went through to the boys' section, and I told them I wanted a job, and they said, okay, take this over to the Ferry Aviation Company and report. I don't know where I had to report, but I reported somewhere. The Ferry Aviation Company gave me a job. I was an office boy, I suppose, in the wing shop. A wing shop at Ferry in those days was a very large space with trestles on it and wings of swordfish on these trestles going through, being gradually assembled till they went out to the other end. They were at that same stage starting on the production of wings for the albacore, which was the follow-on aircraft, not very successful, but it followed on from the swordfish, another biplane, but with modern sort of cupboarding cockpit at the front and spats on the wheels and bits and pieces, probably about 20 years out of date, but we thought it was good. I did.
Now, what were your...
The wing shop was, as I said, was a large area, and the office was on stilts, or on up high, so that the wing shop didn't have a manager, it had a foreman. They were foremen, not managers. And there was a foreman and an assistant foreman. I can't remember the foreman's name. He was a large, rotund man. He looked a bit like Alfred Hitchcock. He wore a shiny blue serge suit, black boots, and a bowler hat. He'd been in the aircraft industry, I think, for about 20 years. His assistant was a more modern fellow, been to university, was Mr. Wicks, a fiery chap. He wore a two-piece suit, which was modern, and he wore a Trilby hat. And my job really was, A, getting their tea, that was very important, and B, I filed all the amendments to blueprints, which were issued daily. Small amendments came out to all sorts of things on the aircraft. Every day a mass of these small amendments would come out. And my job was to select the appropriate blueprint and attach the small amendment sheet to it. The progress chaser, who worked in the office as well, there were several progress chasers actually, they would see these, and then they would go to the various stores and draw the appropriate part duly amended. They would make sure that it was they had a new radius on a small curve, or, you know, a pressing had a larger radius because there were cracks appearing in the corner, but it was too tight, so they round it off. And that I did. I did that for a year, virtually. During that time, of course, in 1940, we had all the business in France, and then the...
Now, did anything happen in the wing shop? I mean, did things change? Because people being called up, things like that. Did you know?
I wasn't conscious of it. I think most of the guys working on aircraft production were...
Reserved occupation.
I didn't know any of them. The only thing other than the wing shop I remember was the experimental shop.